NARIC is your record industry knowledge network.
Thank you very much for being with us this evening. My name is Tess Taylor. I'm the president of the National Association of Record Industry Professionals. Delighted to have you with us here this evening for our event, part one of GOT Distribution, the Secrets of Modern Music Distribution with Ron Spalding, our special guest. Before I introduce Ron, a quick word about NARIC for those of you here for the first time. And I don't think that's anyone, actually. I think, Mr. San Diego, you have not been here before. So for those of you, only one person here for the first time, we, NARIC, are the biggest music business network in the world. We're in 9 cities around the world based in Los Angeles. We also have a chapter in London. We are now in our 18th year, and we are the leading record industry organization for career development, education, and access in the business. We have a mentor network, a job bank, and search services for our members. I have recently secured jobs for 3 people just within the last 2 weeks. And we have search services, as I said, and an online store where you can purchase audio programs of past NARIC programs like these. We have sample marketing plans, form agreements, and other resources. I encourage you to avail yourself of NARIC.com/shop, where you will also find a nice section of free materials, including recommended attorneys, where I believe both Garrett and Ben are listed. So I'm grateful for our vital membership, which is growing all the time, and I invite you to join NARIC if you're not already a member and sign up on our mailing list so you receive free bulletins. You can follow us, like us, and love us. You can see Ron's handle here, at Ron A. Spalding. I am at Tess Taylor and at NARIC, of course. If you enjoy what you hear this evening, please tweet and Instagram about us, and our hashtag this evening, the official hashtag is NARIC Distrib, trying to be short. So after the event this evening, we'll invite you for feedback. We'll invite you to give your feedback, and the first 10 people who respond will receive a $10 coupon for our shop. So we've got a ton of upcoming events, which you can see on page 2 of your handouts. I won't go over them in too much detail other than to say part 2 will be on March 3rd next week, and your feedback tonight will help us to really focus in on what you need and want the most. We have How to Market and License Music for Hollywood Films and TV in Houston on March 10th. We have another music pitch session with Gabe Hilfer, who has been an award-winning music supervisor, has placed music in Black-ish, The Wrestler, and Black Swan. Those have been his projects. We have an advertising music supervisor session in London on March 23rd. We have a number of programs pending. We do mock negotiations, pitch sessions, workshops, and brunches. So please keep an eye on the calendar at NARIC.com. We have a ton of success stories. Since starting our music pitch sessions, we have nearly 400 placements now for our members, including just 3 more this week. Simon Horrocks of Affix Music just got 3 tracks picked up by Andrea Von Forster in the Dance on Dance competition for Verizon. A number of our members have had huge success. One of them quit her job and bought a house based on a placement that she made in a trailer through one of our pitch sessions. So that may not necessarily be the norm, but it happens, and it's great when it does. Other member, Bobby Drake, had 20 original cues commissioned by VH1, so if you have not yet attended a pitch session, I encourage you to consider it and to do so. You can find more information online. So I want to thank SAE, Institute of Technology, where we are this evening, wonderful school, and we appreciate them enabling us to be here. Special thanks to Kevin McCarty. I also want to thank Irene Capone, my lovely colleague, who has been helping so much to put these events together. I call her the Great Greek, because she's Greek. And also thank you very much to Daniel Lee, who helped check you in. So this evening, I'm going to ask Ron some questions to get it moving. We've got a lot of information to cover. If you have any questions, need clarity, raise your hand. I am going to try to keep questions toward the end. I know that's not entirely possible, but we're going to try because we have a lot to cover. So now to our guest, Ron. Tonight we will discuss how and when to get music distribution, what it costs, how to make the most of it, and work with a team to maximize sales and coverage, how we get the best distribution channels and deals available for both established and developing artists. Our guest speaker has enjoyed a very successful and distinguished career. He has increased market share for every company where he has worked, as well as bottom line revenue, which is saying quite a lot, especially in these days of shrinking music sales. You can review his profile in your handout. Will you please join me in welcoming Ron Spalding? So, Ron, thank you very much for making time. You're a busy guy. I'm so happy to have you here, and we have so much to cover. I hope everyone can hear us online. If not, please email Irene, and she'll get everything sorted out for you. But now we're going to start with the definition of a label versus a distributor, because as you and I have talked, you've told me that there's really a lot of confusion on that point.
There is. Before I dig into some details, I just want to thank each and every one of you for being part of this business. This business is a disrupted business and has been for quite some time. Lots of people see that as, you know, disheartening and frustrating and causes some anxiety. I see it as all opportunity. I think anytime you're going through a transitional period and a time of change, it's a fantastic time to be part of the new music business. And before we really get started, there's one thing about this business of music that will never change. It's about creating demand for the product. At the end of the day, that's really what you have to be in the business of doing, so that people want to pay for something that they can often get for free. So let's talk a little bit about a label. I think that how many artists, label owners do we have in the building?
Raise your hand. So 3, 4, 5.
So I think that oftentimes a label, that role, the distribution company, and the role of an artist, which are three separate roles, get very, very confused, especially when you're new and an entrepreneur and you're beginning to make that journey or in the middle of that journey into startup to big success. So let's talk about a label. What do labels do? How are they structured? First of all, they provide recoupable artist advances, right? Or sometimes not recoupable artist advances, depending on how they structure their deal. But each artist signed to the label should get an advance. There's costs associated that the label covers. They typically cover all marketing, promotion, distribution of music, and they have non-recoupable expenses of basically 50% of certain independent promotion and marketing and video production costs. The details vary by, as our esteemed legal colleagues will tell you, it depends on the contract, but that's kind of a broad stroke. The departments and expertise in a label, usually there's a label head, and that's the person responsible for running the day-to-day label. There's a business affairs / finance department. They do the bookkeeping and the payroll and all of the finances. You have a legal department. That's all contracts and agreements, whether it's feature artist contracts and production agreements and clearances and all kinds of depth of contract, deal points, etc. Recording costs, studio time, producers, engineers, A&R. A&R identifies new talent, and they are also kind of the liaison for that talent in the life of the release or the life of that artist with the label. They do writers, song selection, they work on the creative direction of the project, they do feature artists, they're involved in the artwork, anything to do with creative and bringing that artist to market or that project. You have a creative and art department, which is different. They actually create the artwork and the P&P materials, any kind of material that's forward-facing that requires art. You have marketing department, and which includes product management, which is essentially creates and oversees the overall marketing plan for the release and that artist. They coordinate the promotion, publicity, sales, and marketing campaigns, and they liaise between the other departments around the project. Publicity, strategy and execution around stories, interviews, and TV, online, radio, print, etc. Video, they create, produce, promote music and other artists' video content in all forms. New media strategizes, executes the digital promotion marketing strategy. They work with marketing and creative to ensure that the brand and the strategy are both preserved. Sales. I put an extra long thing on here for sales just because I have quite a background in that, so I want to make sure that we did some job justification. But we, you know, sales, they create, oversee, execute all the retail strategy. They set up the pricing, the retail marketing campaigns. They work with manufacturing and finance to set, you know, physical quantities. They also are responsible for all the placement, be it physical or digital placement in the marketplace, including streaming services. And oftentimes, depending on the label, the video, paid video services, you know, the YouTube and stuff, to make sure the content's uploaded there properly. Promotion. They create the timing and strategy to secure terrestrial, satellite, and digital airplay on the artist. And that's a very complicated job. They work very closely with tour marketing to make sure that the artist is on the road, shaking hands and making introductions to stations along their tour route or not, or a promo tour. International, responsible for either foreign licenses or foreign distribution, and that entire promotional campaign outside of the home territory. Tour marketing. They create budgets, routings, and tours for artists. They're involved in all the promotional and functional elements involving the artist along the tour, including calendaring the events, and et cetera, et cetera. Again, a very busy job. So when you really look at the structure of a label, and that I'm trying to rush through to give you a thumbnail, a lot of it's in the printout. There's a lot of stuff going on there, and there's a lot of pieces of moving parts that one has to pay attention to. So I've run into a lot of artists that own labels. It sounds like a big job if you're going to be creative, and it sounds like it distracts you from the creative process often if you're involved in running the day-to-day business. Lots of times as entrepreneurs, you cannot go out and be signed to a label immediately. You have to fill all those roles or a good portion of those roles while you're recording and while you're putting your best foot forward to get the most creative product out there that you can. So I think that there's two big jobs there, and we can talk about the dreamer, because I think that there's a little bit of that in all of us as it relates to artists and labels. And so hopefully tonight we can start to make some of those big, more broad dreams a reality for everybody in the room.
Good. So, and just parenthetically, I worked at a major label for 5 years. I started in the legal department. I ended up in the marketing department, and quite by coincidence, at one of the labels that was owned by UMVD, where Ron most recently worked. So, small world. And it is a busy, busy job. So, this is the type of support that every artist should have, would like to have, certainly. And we're going to talk about how that works together with distribution and how to make the most of what you have if you are only, you know, small scale, shall we say. So you have a question here about owning a label. How many people own a label? Okay. And how many of you guys currently have a distribution deal? So, one, two? Do you, CJ?
Yeah.
Who with?
Mamba.
All right. So, and how many of you have just, well, two of you with distribution deals interested in making a change? Yes, no, maybe?
Yes.
Yes.
Maybe after next part two.
Okay.
Week.
All right, good. Okay. So distributors, provide distribution for labels and in select cases individual artists, but a distributor is not a label. Did you want to?
Yeah, I think that's really important.
Discuss the difference?
I think that, and being in several distribution companies, I think it's very confusing. People think that the distribution company is the label. It's not. The distribution company's responsibility is to put the product in the marketplace. Now, that has a few tentacles that you may sign a possible advance with a content provider, in that if there's catalog there, or if you can look through and say, hey, we have good sales upside on this, so provide an advance. And advances are not free. They're loans. I've even went as far as to charge interest on some of the advances that I've provided over the years. Ben can probably attest to that. Most recently, it was always a point of contention, because you put money out there gambling with labels and artists, and you expect to get it back. And if it fails, I didn't have a whole lot of people write a check. So, you know, you need to make sure that's protected. So there's possible advance. They manufacture, warehouse the physical product. And they are the pipelines on the digital and physical product into the marketplace. They sometimes have international capabilities, and that's either in-house or through affiliates worldwide that they might provide international distribution. They collect the dollars from the retailers, obviously. They take a fee off the top of that, and then they send those proceeds over to you. And they sell and position the releases, both digital and physical. They work in conjunction with the label to maximize the marketing plan. It's in everybody's best interest on both timing, pricing. And they negotiate and leverage any co-op and positioning at the retailers, which still exists out there. And in some instances, some of the major owned distribution companies, they offer label services, so they can provide a good amount of structure and a good amount of resources around the services that I described that a label might provide, even as far as promotion and publicity, et cetera, et cetera.
And apropos of that, Ron, you provided, I think, here on page 5, some of the fees, which I believe are per unit fees, that go along with...
Yeah, and these are ballpark numbers. Again, all of those fees on page 5 that you see there, it depends. Like manufacturing, you know, I put in a number of 70 cents. That's presuming that there's, you know, a 4-panel booklet on the physical side. It could be more, it could be less. You can get done a lot less out there. You can, if you're with a distributor, they will provide that manufacturing and distribution cost. Typically, they'll do that, and they'll take that risk, so that doesn't have to necessarily come out of your pocket. There's, as you can go down this list, there's, you know, returns handling fees. They get returns. They, you know, sometimes charge 2%, and these are averages. Again, it depends by contract. Product stickering, 10% if they have to do that. UPC change, they charge you 35 cents a unit. Cutouts marked for promotion is usually 10 cents a unit. Scrapping, 10 cents a unit if they want to destroy the product. Refurbish of returns where you put it back in the marketplace or a quarter a unit sometimes. Product transfer, maybe 34 cents if they're sending it to a different warehouse or something because you own the product if you're the label. You know, sometimes they charge for new release book pages that they for inclusion in a new release book that they solicit customers with. That can be $400 or $500. And then they charge a penalty if you miss the street date on occasion or the street date of the new release book. So if the new release book is scheduled to, you have to have your materials in on Tuesday and you turn them in on Friday, they upcharge you for that. And then they have a la carte pricing for label services depending on what services you may need and what they may provide. And that can run on a monthly fee or a per project fee. So those are some of the hidden, I shouldn't say hidden, but those are some of the costs to consider as you go through your distribution consideration and things that might pull down your bottom line profit.
Can you explain here, under fees, physical and digital distribution fee is a percentage of net sales less returns and fees. This includes ad-based services and flat fee services, i.e. subscriptions.
So they typically, and again, I'll say it for the last time, I won't say it the rest of this meeting, but honestly, it depends on your contract. But the fee is a, you know, let's say your distribution fee is 20%. They charge that on, you know, net business, so it's less returns and any of those other fees that we just described or any other fees that are in your contract that you use. And they take that off the top. Then if they've given you an advance, they recoup their money typically at 100%. So you won't see dollar one until you pay them back their money typically, unless you're well established and you might be able to move that around a little bit. And then the subscription services and the ad-based services typically – distributors have a relationship, whether it's with YouTube or Spotify or any of the streaming services out there, video or audio, and they take a fee on being responsible for that. There's also another thing, Tess, that I think is important is when we talk about reserves and return reserves. Distributors are used to...
Hold on a sec. Does everybody know what reserves are? Why don't you explain reserves?
Distributors typically have held a percentage of the proceeds payable to a label or an artist in anticipation of returns in the marketplace. So they look at SoundScan and they look at, you know, how many they've shipped, and they get a good estimation of how many units are sitting in the marketplace. And they will hold 20-25%. They may hold more. It's usually at their discretion if that number looks like it's very high and they're going to get hit with returns. And they can hold that money for, you know, typically on the front end of a distribution deal, it's 6 to 9 months. It can be that long. So you don't get that money, that 25% or 20%, until they understand what the liability in the marketplace and the returns are processed. There's also an overreaching piece. Now I feel like I'm a lawyer, right? If you're not careful, they will hold those return reserves on digital, and there are no returns on digital. So as you start to go through that process to ink a distribution deal, you want to make sure that you're not paying for reserves on digital and streaming services, because it doesn't make sense.
Okay. Good. Is that all clear?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
sir. Alles klar. Okay. So working our way down here, monitoring sales. Let's go over that, because that's important.
All right. Monitoring sales. I mean, digital sales tools are very straightforward because you typically have access to a dashboard at either the digital service providers or through your distributor, where you can see almost real-time sales at almost every major digital provider and streaming service. So you can see where your money is there and where your success is or isn't there in almost real time. And so I think that on the physical, it's a little bit more interesting, right? You have a pipeline report where I just described you have SoundScan, which we'll talk a little bit about here in a minute, and you have the shipments. So you can kind of start to get close to, you know, how much products in the marketplace. You can see what you're selling a week. You can see how many weeks of supply you have, how many pieces are in the marketplace, how long it's going to take you to burn the inventory, and also what your revenues can be off of that, right? So that's SoundScan on the physical side, and I do want to dig into that a little bit, Tess, so we'll start to define out how you look at that.
Let me ask just trend-wise, okay, because we're moving rather quickly now towards streaming. How much has physical manufacturing shrunk over the last 5 years?
Oh, it's been dramatic. I wouldn't want to give you a percentage, but I know that at some of the majors right now, that streaming is accounting for over 50% of their revenue.
Really? Okay.
Over 50% of revenue just in the streaming side of the business. So it's really starting to increase. And you throw in digital, and track sales have gotten beat up in the last couple years, as you see. They've taken some pretty significant decreases.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still very viable and very real. And the one thing I love about digital track sales, if people want to own things, is stores open 24/7 worldwide,
right.
So you can get it anytime you want.
Right. That is good. Okay. So SoundScan. SoundScan evaluates physical sales, and now also digital, right?
It does.
And we have a measure for, I think I saw in here somewhere, how many streams or downloads equals a physical sale? How do they calculate that exactly?
They look at 10 songs that are streamed to equal one albums. Album sales. 10 digital songs sold are equal one album.
Okay.
And 1,500 streams equals an album.
Okay.
And the RIA just published their kind of new metrics of, like, 150 streams is a song. So
okay.
It starts to equate to.
Okay, great. So SoundScan, walk us through that and what we need to know. And especially, I think, important when you are working with the distributor is to get access to their SoundScan reporting, because as an individual, it's painfully expensive. But that should be part of anybody's contract, to have the ability to, you know, review your own, at least your own sales records,
right,
on, you know, the subscription basis of the distributor.
That's right. And SoundScan, you know, for all the right reasons, protects their data pretty closely, because
mm-hmm.
they are expensive. They're very strict about passing passcodes around, allowing people access. I've seen many times people get shut off from their accounts for having multiple, you know, IPs, you know, addresses out there accessing the same account. They're very diligent about that. So it's very protected, but your distributor should absolutely provide you with your own products, an overview on SoundScan, And you can sometimes pull at them to give you some stuff, especially if you're looking to sign an artist or you're looking to pursue an artist that has a history. You know, that's an important tool to take a look at.
Okay. So let's go through here. All right. So did you want to add something?
No. Okay. You want to talk about sound scan reporting
so
a little bit?
How to read a sound scan report.
Yep. I brought a couple pieces of sound scan here so that we could kind of walk through it. They are continually Nielsen-owned sound scan, which is a really robust data company. And they're continually trying to keep up with the marketplace as this shift from physical to downloads to streaming and combining that to try and come up with an overall view of how much consumption really is out there and how much demand for a product and how that consumer is getting that product. So if you look at the two big charts, the Billboard Top 200 chart, it is listed here. You know, you have label, company, artist, title. You have weekly trend activity, which that they're combining now the sales of the album. They're taking the song sales at 10 songs or 10 tracks per album, as equates to, they're adding that to the sales, and they're adding the 1,500 streams per to equate to an album. They're coming up with a total number that looks like that. So if you looked at Adele on this report, she sold 151,000, was up 25%, because they give you this week versus last week. Her total album sales that week were 124,000. So the song sales were 206,000, and the stream activity that week was 8.7 million. So they've combined that number to get her to a total number of 151 for the week, right? So, and she only sold, well, I shouldn't say only, that's a big number, right? She sold 124,000 albums that week of what I'm reporting. So there's another, you know, 30,000 units that is between streams and song sales.
Okay, good. So, and do you want to pass that around for people to have
sure.
a look? I mean, it's just a huge
yep,
spreadsheet.
I have my handwritten notes on the top. The rest of the charts, when you look at the top album charts, And the tracks and the songs and et cetera, they're just looking at this week's sales, actual sales versus last week's sales, and the rankings and the percentage change. That's it. The first one is the that you have in your hand is the top 200, and then this is a top album chart here. So I'll let you look at them side by side because you can see the difference because the one doesn't take into account either the tracks or the streams.
Okay.
All right. The other thing I think, Tess, that's important to mention is the national sales and the DMA sales. And I'll pass that around for you, too. I'll give you. I just want to make sure I capture some of the data on the front end of it.
DMA stands for?
It's the individual market sales per location. There's the 101 markets typically listed on. So New York is typically number one because there's the most people there. So your sales is typically the biggest there. Excuse me, and it goes down to Puerto Rico. And you can, if you have access to SoundScan or somebody that does, they have tons and tons and tons of subset reports that you can really start to break down and analyze the business overall. So this DMA report can go much deeper than these markets, these 101 markets here too. So.
And this is also SoundScan, or this is a different report altogether?
Yeah, this is coming from Nielsen SoundScan.
Okay. Got it.
Excuse me, guys. Let me get a quick drink here.
Okay. So I want to ask you, when you've had your water, how do you use this data? I mean, you see the coverage. You see where it's selling exactly. They give you geographical information because it used to be that SoundScan didn't want you to know where the sales numbers were coming from specifically. They didn't want you to know which stores were reporting. So how has that changed? How much geographical information do you have to be able to move more product into the marketplace where it's really selling?
I think that the reports are virtually the same. They've matured them a little bit, but the markets are still there, and they still, you know, there are SoundScan reporters in specific markets, and it used to be back in the day that just like on the radio play charts, if somebody was reporting, they would try and influence the stores to report more sales, right? So
they kept that a secret.
They did, because they didn't want that information to come in to not be legitimate, right? So, you know, as you might imagine, people would try and influence it. They were shipping free goods in, and there was a time where they were written down, too. So you could call up the clerk. I have a great relationship with the clerk. You'd be like, hey, you know, put another box in there this week for me in this store. And so they really tried to protect that information for that very reason, so that it wouldn't be manipulated and that the data would actually be correct. But now, since everything's point of sale for the most part, mm-hmm. and we'll talk a little bit about weighting. I know that was one of the things that we wanted to cover. But now that it's point of sale, it's much more difficult to influence. People typically don't influence it nearly as well. And honestly, it's much more accurate, so that you don't end up with bad numbers against shipments. You know, when it was manipulated, you could have, negative on hands in the marketplace, right? And it was like, okay, well, that doesn't help anybody in the accounting department. At the end of the day, it's gross and net sales tells you what you're going to get paid from the accounting department. They don't pay off a sound scan. So it looks good and it's great for the ego, but it's not so good for the checkbook. This national report that I'll pass around for you guys really starts to show, it has obviously all the pertinent information of label and artist, et cetera. But the real keys on this report is that there's a 2016 year-to-date number that it shows. It also shows digital. It has a percentages of the total.
Hold on, this shows year-to-date of the label or of the product?
This is one product. One album release or track release would look the same.
Okay.
And then it shows over on the right-hand side, release-to-date, it starts to break out whether it's CD and digital and what those percentages are. And it also gives overall business conditions this week versus last week and year-to-date. So whether the business is up on this particular report, business was up 7% this week versus last week. And then the year-to-date number in total is over in the margin at the top. So you get kind of a market perspective of where the market is. And then you go into much more detailed information about, where the product's been sold. So chain, independent, mass merchant, digital, non-traditional, internet, mail order, and venue. And then non-traditional retail outlets. There's also a geographical region, which is at a high level. So northeast, mid-Atlanta, east, north, central, west, north, central.
So let me ask you a few things here, Ron. This is
yep. So
much information, it's just overwhelming. Okay. are you getting this every day? Does it come in real time?
Comes in,
is it every week? How often?
It comes in once a week. This was printed on 225, so it'll come in 7 days from 225.
Okay, so this is today's, right? Okay. And when you have that for a client or an artist or any release on your on your label through your distributor, what do you glean from this? What action do you take or not take?
Understood.
Because this is so many numbers and so much data, what do we do with it?
There is. On the first page, I really look at where the business is at first, right? If the business is up 7% this week and this particular record is up 6%, I know I'm 1% behind the market. So I didn't do as good as the market. If I'm flat, I would have been up 7%. So that's the first thing I look at to see whether I'm keeping pace with the overall market or not and whether we have work to do there. And then you can look at it by geography. And if you have activity in that market, mm-hmm. if you have a tour, you have airplay, you have other things going on, you should be seeing sales spikes in the overall geography of the release. When you turn the page is where it gets really interesting, because it breaks it down by city. Like I said, there's 101 cities that you can easily see, and you can dig down even more deep than that. And it starts to talk, it has basically 4 weeks in the overall sales of the project. And it has percentages and rank. So you can start to see where you're ranking on a chart. You can start to see whether or not, if you were in New York last week and you had a show, that market should be up because there's awareness in the marketplace. And it should be up more than the market. So if it's up 7% and you're up 10%, you figure you have a 3% swing. Those are the things I look at to start to really get a handle on whether we're doing a good job on this release in general.
Mm-hmm. Is it still the case that SoundScan charges for these reports and for this service a percentage of the market share of the company?
You know, I don't know exactly. I've not been involved in the SoundScan negotiations, okay. but I do believe that's still the case. Okay. But I wouldn't want to go on record to say that that's absolute.
Okay. So then, and independent labels or individuals are able to get, I think, a special rate. At least they were willing to talk to you back in the day. Because you're obviously, you know, if you're an independent label, you probably have no market share or very small. So that's probably done on an a la carte basis. But it's worth talking to SoundScan about, because this information you can really take action with, and it becomes even more important if you're going on tour.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
Okay.
And when you're getting airplane stuff, and I'll pass these around, and you can start to kind of look through, you know, some of the information on it. But honestly, it's a great tool to be able to dig down, especially when you have activity, whatever that activity is in the marketplace, to see whether or not you're keeping pace or it's paying off. If you paid X amount of dollars for a promo tour, you went to 10 cities and you didn't see sales spikes, then that's a bad investment where I come from.
Right. So is this the only game in town, the SoundScan Nielsen numbers, or can you get similar data from elsewhere?
It's the industry standard right now.
It's the industry standard, okay.
It is. There's been much discussion with some groups out there about whether they compete or not, but Nielsen still has been the standard in the companies that I've worked with. You know, when I sat around the table and they were firing questions about why is this market down and why is that market up and why did that happen over there and we should have spent the money on that. And that's the kind of analysis you should be doing with this report.
Okay, very good. So we skipped over something that's very important. I want to go back to aggregator or distributor. Who does what and what's the difference?
The aggregator... There's lots of aggregators out there that people are providing distribution services. And the reason that they do that and the reason that distribution companies do that is they don't want to have a multitude of deals out there with low volume, mm-hmm. you know, repertoire providers or labels. So there are aggregators in place that are either sanctioned or not. Some people have a distribution deal and will offer that service to put your product through their distribution deal that they already have. And then there are other aggregators that, at least I believe, I don't know if it happens at all companies, the companies I work with, I sanctioned a couple companies and said, look, when I get product in and I see an artist and a standalone artist, because those are tough deals, I want to send that to this company, let them manage that day to day. I already have a fee structure, I don't have to do a new deal. And then I'll be able to distribute the product because it's attractive to me. The key here, guys, is cross-collateralization. Because as a label owner, right, and as somebody who has a distribution deal, if you put out 10 records or 2 records, and one of them, let's say you put out 2 records, one of them successful and one of them fails, you're going to get one report and one check from the distribution company. So if you spent $50,000 on this record and it failed and you have another artist or another record over here that's doing great and you owe them $100,000 and your record company only sends you $50 because that $50 was a bad investment, you have to make up the difference. Because you got to pay the artist their, you know, what you owe them on the royalties. So that's really the real catch and another reason that the aggregation business is risky and can be difficult because they have to cover that difference.
Well, but
if
can
they
you,
have
when working with an aggregator, can you prevent cross collateralization of your projects?
It's tough.
Okay.
And I can't speak for every distributor out there. I wouldn't have done a deal where it wasn't cross collateralized.
Okay.
Because I don't want to take the risk. Otherwise, I just do the deal with the artist directly, right?
Okay. So cross collateralization, beware.
It's important because as a label, no matter whether you have a distribution deal or you don't, you've got to pay your mechanicals and artist royalties or you get a really bad relationship with your artists if you're not paying them.
And that's the label's job.
It's the label's job. And, you know, even if you sign a sub-distribution, you still have to pay them for their results, right? So if I have a distribution deal with Gene and I've agreed to do a 20% distribution deal with Gene, he's going to expect 80% of his money to come back based on his success.
How exactly are mechanicals paid? Are they paid on records not shipped, obviously, but actually sold for which you have a report?
Mechanicals, yeah. I mean, mechanicals are paid for sales, and it's typically 9.1. I think this is still true. So
9.1 cents.
I think it's 9.1 cents for any song 3 minutes and 50 seconds long or less. I believe that's still the case.
And then it goes up when your song is over 5 minutes. But I guess the point was, how do you define sales before that mechanical royalty is paid?
Is it on shipments, Gene? Do you know?
I think so.
Okay.
But I'm not actually certain about that, because typically the mechanicals, and I spent much time in the distribution side, are paid by the label.
Mm-hmm.
The label's responsible for mechanicals, because in the label relationship, just to go back and visit, mm-hmm. sorry to belabor this. If you have a 15% distribution deal with an artist in your label, a royalty deal with them, 85% of the money is going to go to the label, but you have all those costs that I started to describe in the first breath of this sit-down that we're having. So, and that includes paying, you know, the publishers and mechanicals,
mm-hmm.
typically. So that's a big job for the label. They got to take on all the risk of the promotion and marketing, with the exception of maybe a 50% on some of those services that they share.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get the bulk of the money back. The artist number, the 15% royalty, typically comes off of wholesale less any discounts or anything that's sold out there. So they're do that regardless.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is this all clear?
It's complicated, but publishing is an interesting area of our business, and it's they're doing very well, the publishers out there. So, you know, you have to make sure that they're getting paid, and that the creative entities in this business, mm-hmm. that's our lifeblood, are getting paid. So,
okay. Any questions about the algebra we're discussing?
I'm sure there are some.
Okay.
Nothing?
It's all clear. It's good.
That's
all right.
Scary to me.
Okay.
Because I'm not sure I'm clear, but no.
Okay. You're clear enough. Okay. So, and we're clear on the difference between an aggregator and a distributor, because that is important. Okay. So, independent versus major distribution. A major distributor isn't really going to pay attention to someone with less than how many units? Or sales,
you know,
history of sales.
I mean, it's still an emotional business. You know, a lot of times in the contract part of it, they'll put a minimum annual number in their
mm-hmm.
test to make sure that if you're a big distribution house, you don't want to be in business with a bunch of people doing $10,000 a year. It doesn't make sense. You know, you want to be in the volume, more of a volume business.
The Taylor Swift business.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, if you're talking about independent records, you still want to be in where people have a flow of product, they have a flow of music coming into the marketplace, and you have enough volume there, because you got a staff to pay, you got overhead to cover, right?
Right.
So there's typically a lot of people in the building. You typically ought to figure out what that volume number is. I mean, people set numbers, but at the end of the day, it's still a passion business. You have something that somebody really wants, you have a great shot of getting a deal done, right? And if you have a relationship with somebody there that really believes in you as an executive or your artist as an artist, that goes a long way in having a real conversation. I did a lot of distribution deals in my career based on how I believed that the executive team was going to do. And I know that sounds crazy, but I'm a gut guy, and I believe, like, hey, if I get the executive team passionate and right, they'll find the talent and they'll match the talent and they'll bring the records to me,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be able to be successful in the distribution company with their passion of going out there and doing a great job.
Okay.
And that still exists. You know, it's still a relationship business.
Okay. So you were running Fontana
mm-hmm.
for a while. Also worked at Universal Music Video and Distribution, UMVD, the largest in the world, the largest distribution company in the world. So when, passion aside, you know, you also have to be practical. An artist comes to you or a label comes to you. How do you decide whether they go down the UMVD road or Fontana?
Well, I never made the decision for Universal Music Group Distribution.
Okay.
But typically that relationship in the major houses, be it Sony, Warner, or Universal, they have wholly owned labels. which is, you know, their bread and butter, because they own, you know, Universal Republic, they own Interscope, they own, you know, those labels. Warner owns Atlantic, you know, Sony owns Columbia. Those are good deals because they can use their repertoire, and their focus is on that repertoire because it's what we call wholly owned, right? They wholly own the repertoire. They're paying a royalty rate to the artist, and then all those other costs they're amortizing over volume, right? So their distribution fees are coming down, and all the other costs involved with the flow of product. So they're very focused on their wholly owned labels, as they should be, and their wholly owned artists and repertoires. There are deals to be done there, and it's typically with real large level success. You know, if you know, there are certain labels that'll get distributed through there, like Big Machine. They have a little artist by the name of Taylor Swift. They have a direct deal with Universal. I think it goes through Universal Republic, but it's right there. So that's a big enough you know, entity for them to take a chance on. And you know, that team down there is really great at what they do. And so they believe in that team. And they believe in that team when they did that deal. And they had good history with that team. So on the independent side, Tess, it's about flow of product and the confidence in the team that you're working with, honestly. So again, they don't want to do small deals where they're constantly looking at small volume deals. But if there's enough product flow and they believe that the label owner and the repertoire is great, that they can make top line numbers on it, they'll absolutely do those deals. They're in the business to do distribution deals.
So let's say that you have an artist or a smaller label. What sort of marketing plan do you want? We've talked about team, we've talked about passion, volume, numbers, sales history. What kind of marketing plan do you need to see in place? Because as we have discussed earlier, there's this misconception that you get distribution and then records start to sell. But the truth is that you can put anything out there, but without knowledge of it in the marketplace or the ability to stimulate demand, there is no demand. So the marketing plan is a huge part of that, and I'm assuming you wouldn't touch a release with a 10-foot pole unless there was a very good marketing plan behind it.
Right. Yes? Right. You know, the again, that goes back to the team. You're believing that the team inside the label can build and execute on a great marketing plan for new releases and even some established repertoire. A lot of the criteria that, if I'm in business with a label, I'm believing they're going to be able to come up with a marketing plan that they're going to be able to execute on and create the demand. You have to, before you get the distribution deal, be focused on creating demand, and after you get the distribution deal, it's even more important to create demand. So I looked for traction. If I did an individual artist deal, which I didn't do a ton of them, I did a few of them, that I always looked for traction in the project. I always looked at that there was some work done. It wasn't starting from scratch, because I'm a distribution company. I'm not a label, right? That's a very different role. The label's job is to build the demand. The distribution company's job is to take advantage of the demand that's built, right? So that demand building process of having, they look at great socials now. That's really important, because you can get a sense of how big the marketplace is for that release. You're looking at whether or not they are out there on the road touring, what kind of shows they're playing. Are they getting paid to play the shows, or they're paying to play the shows? And then last but certainly not least, you know, this is the cherry on top. Do they have radio? You know, it's still a great driver of awareness and a great driver of results. Do they have radio? What kind of radio? Is it AAA radio? Is it something that can go to pop? If it's going to go to pop, do they have the money to be able to take it there? Do they have, you know, are they going to come to me as a distribution company halfway into the relationship and say, hey, we've got a song at radio and I need $100,000. You know, I need $100,000 or we can't get it there. And then the distributor, you're going, do I bet the $100,000 on this play that we're going to be able to get there and get the sales out of it? Or do I pull back and then I know I'm not going to get the sales out of it? So that's a real gut check when the label's just shy on the money side, right as the record's grabbing traction, you know?
Okay. Wow. Okay, so good marketing plan. Really, really important to stimulate demand. We're going down the list here of things to just to consider when you're looking at independent versus major distribution. So the development of the company and the artist, what type of catalog or how much catalog there is. You've talked about relationship, reach, especially social media, the services that might be needed, because radio is cherry on top, but one of the most expensive.
It is.
Especially pop radio. And the economics of all of these things. So you're crunching the numbers. You're looking at how much has been spent, how much of a marketing budget there is, because it's typical for music to be made, the producer, the artist, the label to make the music, and then to leave nothing for marketing.
Right. I think my experience would be that when I'm talking about major distribution companies, I'm talking about major owned distribution companies, and that's Caroline is over at Universal,
mm-hmm.
Red is over at Sony, and you have ADA at Warner. Those are the three independent distribution companies sitting inside of a major music company, worldwide music
mm-hmm.
company. So those companies have a little bit higher requirements typically, and on the volume, a little bit more aggressive view of who they're going to be in business with,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the non-major owned. Doesn't make them less effective, doesn't make them a bad choice at all, but they may look at it a little bit differently because those three major distribution companies, I'm presuming, are in the volume business. They're trying to get volume and market share and drive real results out of there. So there's a couple different tiers of choices. I think looking at a direct deal with Universal, Sony, or Warner, I think those are really big steps, and they're really big labels that would get that consideration.
Okay, very good. So moving down the list here, we're covering a lot. Thank you. So submission requirements, especially for digital, which is what so many people are doing.
Yep.
What kind of submission requirements are there? And let's touch on ISRC codes and the importance of getting that right.
And submission requirements, Tess, I'm sorry, in terms of delivering
to the distributor.
To the distributor, right. They'll have a standard in and around all the different things that they'll require. They'll require a one sheet, and that starts with a UPC and ISRC code.
Does everybody know what a one sheet is? A one sheet is one sheet, and it's typically got a photo of the album art or the artist, so you know at a glance, are we looking at a lute player or a band of 45 women in leather gear? You know, at a glance, you should have a concept of the artist and maybe even what genre is in. You have a track listing, the UPC code. You'd have the label and the contact information. You would have, a few bullet points touring the Midwest starting in May 1st, whatever. Anything that would be of interest to a buyer to show that you've got some action or traction or you've got a plan in place. So the one sheet, if it's done well, is almost a mini marketing plan. But it's very well designed. I have some older ones. I was hoping we might get some more current ones from Ron, but I'll be happy to share the ones that I have. And if we can get one from him, I will make that available too. So, yeah, the one sheet is what is used by the distributor to solicit stores, sales, retail, and digital. Very, very important, and it's important for you to get this right. It's got to be simple, clear, and communicate what's available for sale, what the wholesale price is, the retail price, any pricing information that would be needed. So that's what a one sheet is.
Yep, and you have your barcodes on there and your track listing and the run times on the tracks too,
mm-hmm.
typically. But you should have your high-level marketing points on there, so if you have a late-night TV show or you have a certain amount of publicity and features in different publicity opportunities, that should be listed on there, the highlights of your marketing plan.
Yeah, or you're going on tour, you got performances, yes.
And then, it's interesting, Tess, we should talk a little bit about UPC and ISRC codes because they are
important,
often misunderstood
as
well.
Let's talk about what each one is and what the difference is.
Yes, the ISRC code is the International Standard Recording Code, and that is basically it's basically a number that follows that track forever. So it's in the metadata, And that's the track identifier that everybody would use forever. Mm-hmm. It's fairly easy to obtain. It's fairly easy to maintain. You can, if you're with a distributor, oftentimes they will have bought blocks of both UPC codes and ISRC codes, mm-hmm. and you can go in and request them from them, and they'll provide them for you. If not, mm-hmm. you can go online tonight and buy them yourself. The ISRC codes, I think, is $85 for an annual subscription, and mm-hmm. you can go into usisrc.org, and there's tons of information about it. You need to report the code use. You need to renew that fee annually. That's very important.
So when you pay $85, that's not for one code. That's for a series of codes?
Yeah, you can buy up to 100,000 codes, and they're very cheap. They're not expensive on an annualized basis. And you're supposed to renew it every year because there's a number in there that dictates the year. So it'll be 16 this year, next year it'll be 17. You're not supposed to use 16-year codes and 17-year releases. So
now, see, I'm hearing this for the first time. I thought the number didn't change.
It never changes once you assign it to a track. So that track goes out into the world, and it's supposed to live with that track forever. But I'm talking about new products.
I see.
So if you have, you put this track out this year, next year you're putting out a different track from a different artist, it will have a 17 in it instead of a 16 to start to...
But do I have to continue to pay for the 16 and the 15 and the 14?
No, I don't believe you do. Okay. I think it's just an annual renewal, I think, of if it's $85. If you continue to renew it...
You just get more numbers.
You can get more numbers and you can buy new... But it keeps your account active and you should... It's cheap. If it's $85 a year, just renew it annually.
And by the way, that is one of the major, if not the major ways, which... publishers use to track so that you get paid for your syndicated materials. Yes.
Is this an American thing to register with this? Because in Australia, I've never registered song ISRC codes through that website, so now I'm concerned.
I mean, this is the site we use here.
Yeah, okay.
So
there's... Hold on, Mick. Are you going to answer her question?
Well, I was just going to add...
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
There's... ISRC offices in all the different territories. So if you're operating out of Australia, you would register with the Australian office.
Right.
But it's an international organization.
It'll track it, and it'll track it worldwide.
Let me repeat the question for our online listeners. So we have an Australian, lovely, very successful songwriter, Miss Bowie Jane, who was very concerned because she has never registered with ISRC, and she's a writer in...
The ISRC codes assigned to the tracks, but I've never bought the ISRC codes, that's for sure.
But then one of our...
Where'd you get the ISRC codes? I'm sorry.
I think APRA told us how to code it,
Who is that? I'm sorry?
APRA, the Australian Performing Rights Association.
I'm sure you're fine there.
Yeah, and it was AU and then the year and then... But I didn't buy the numbers.
Well, it's worth double-checking.
Yeah.
And then our very alert young member here, Mick Wainman, said that IRC offices exist in every territory and should be or can be registered through them. But it's worth following up on because this is the most important data of all to enable you to get paid, especially in the digital world, right?
Yeah, and it also, it's easy to do. So take your time and go back and just make sure you've done it right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can say this. I just had an album by... I had it made myself through Disc Makers, and they actually created it for me
mm-hmm.
with a function on their online registration.
Okay.
And I go through the aggregator TuneCore, they will create those codes for you as well.
Okay, so Disc Makers created the ISRC code, and TuneCore will create the ISRC code for you. Shout out to Disc Makers, Sydney Alston, came in a little late, but... good to have you here. So, good to know. But I wouldn't leave it to chance. I would make sure that it's done right. Yes.
I think what she's actually referring to is their version of possibly ASCAP, because a lot of placement stuff that I do, honestly, I don't get an ISRC for it. I'm relying on the television, on the editors to to enter that in the cue sheets.
Yeah.
So that's probably this your version.
Right.
I'm guessing.
Right.
I'd be very wrong.
But you know, as a Virgo, I have to say it's very important to make sure that that information is available, embedded, entered, whatever it is. And especially with respect to cue sheets, when you're licensing music, I would always make as part of the licensing agreement a requirement that a cue sheet come to you, the rights holder, so that you can review and make sure everything is accurate and correct. All right?
Right.
Yes, Ezra. Okay, so...
And then there's the UPC code.
Which stands for?
Universal Product Code, right?
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So... Universal product codes or UPC codes, I would go to Grand South One,
mm-hmm.
And you need to keep that current. They're not cheap. I think they're about $8 to $12. You would probably know it, disc makers. About $8 to $12 per UPC code, is that right?
$20.
Really? Okay.
So it's not cheap, and you can buy them in blocks as well, 100 code blocks. And the key there is you have a label code that you should be following that marks all your products and it has some consistency in it. The long and short of it is if you, it's not often, and this is being overly paranoid, but when you aren't current on your UPC codes and you're not maintaining them, if somebody doesn't go current and somebody, there's risk there that your product could actually get caught up in an audit and pulled out of the stores, or your, you know, UPC code. I had a friend of mine that had grabbed some UPC codes that were assigned to a milk company. So it was like, you know, just go, and it's not cheap, but it's necessary.
Now, one UPC code applies to one album?
Yes.
Okay. As opposed to the ISRC code, which is on a per track basis.
Right.
And if you do a remix or an extended version, that's a new ISRC code.
It is. Anytime you change length or anything to do with the track.
It's a new track.
It's right. And the UPC code stays the same for digital and physical as long as the album's the same. If you put two extra tracks on a digital album that you don't on a physical album, you need to have a different code there too.
Okay. Yes, sir. Costas?
If a UPC is for an album and you have independent, well, you have songs in the album, of course, those songs have ISRCs, right? Are those 10 ISRCs, for example, connected to that one
UPC? So the question, let me repeat it for our online listeners. If you have an album or a release out and you have 10 tracks, each of which has its own unique ISRC code, are those unique 10 ISRC codes connected to the one unique UPC code?
You need to separate albums and tracks. So if the album is the same, right, the UPC code can be the same on physical and digital. Otherwise, it'll change if you have a different lineup of tracks. But the ISRC code is on a track level. It's possible, but I very very rarely see it put in the mastering process on a physical album. It can be, but I don't see it very often.
All right. Sydney?
I got a question. Is it important to embed the barcode on the CD if you make CDs?
Is it important to embed the barcode on the CD?
I don't know about that. You mean embed the UPC code on the physical CD? You mean print it or embed it in the actual?
Embed it in the actual, encoded into the CD.
I'm not familiar with that.
No. It is.
It is?
It is.
Mm-hmm. Say it again, Gene.
No. Yes, it's in the data section of the CD itself. Both
audio and physical.
Not audio, just
I think that was your question, right?
Yeah. But what does that do? Why is that important?
That's how it's digitally read.
In a part of the CD, correct?
In the CD.
The metadata of the CD.
So the UPC code should be embedded in the metadata of the audio file.
Right.
All right.
That's what you were asking about, the metadata. I'm sorry, I missed. Yeah.
Okay.
I think there's a little of confusion between the two, and we need to clear that. The first five digits and the UPC are the your ID as a company.
Correct.
Okay.
Very important to remember. So let's say somebody will do that through this maker, what have you. You actually tell to the world this CD belongs to them. So you got to be very careful.
Okay. So let me, David, hold on. I want to just repeat this for the online listeners. So David, a Yacobian who has a label, says it's very important to keep in mind that the first five digits of the UPC code are the indicator of the company itself. So if Disc Makers is assigning the UPC code, then your CD basically says with its UPC code that it's a Disc Makers disc.
Right.
Right?
The following five digits would be the ID of the particular album.
Okay.
Now, there's another confusion here. That mostly
let me repeat that. So the following five, the next five digits of the UPC code are for the album.
Yes, the ID of that album. Now, when you provide that, for example, in my case, to the Orchard, they will take that, but along with that, they will create also their own digital ID number for their system.
Okay.
So that, you know, you've got to be very careful with the whole thing.
Okay.
In the metadata, all you can create really is the UPC. Later on, let's say in that case, Orchard, will take that information and apply a different number for the internal system.
Okay, so beware. There's lots of people putting numbers on your product. Make sure the numbers are correct. They accurately reflect ownership, specifically your ownership, and invest in your own UPC codes.
Another important thing is this. If you are going physical, you got to remember the following five numbers, the ID of the album. Many companies will also use that as a catalog number. In other words, if you're saying around, they would put it also, if you notice, on the spine, these kind of numbers. So that's the ID of this particular CD.
Okay.
And that's what they go by.
So very often, the last five digits of the UPC code will be used as a catalog number by the label.
Right.
All right.
Give me an example.
Hold on 1 second. Sydney?
Just real quick about the barcode, right? If you do buy a third-party barcode, like from Disc Makers or somebody like that, you can fill out what's called a SoundScan Title Edition form.
Okay, if you do purchase a third-party UPC code, you can fill out a SoundScan
Title Edition
form. Title Edition form.
Right, and that registers that barcode and that record under whoever fills out the information.
Okay, so then that's registering. Okay.
Be careful with that, too. Be careful with that, too, because what's going to happen... I'm talking all from experience of many years. I had to learn it the hard way. You go, for example, now to XYZ company and you want to distribute that, and they see that that exact what Ron said, there's a confusion all of a sudden, there's a crossover, and then they spit it out. They said that doesn't belong to you.
Okay, so beware, beware the numbers.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You can actually have retailers, you don't see it often, pull it out of there.
Absolutely.
Pull the stock out and send it back.
Yes.
Okay. So those numbers are important. By the way, so I'm repeating this for our online audience, and if our online audience has a question, perhaps you could tweet it, hashtag NARIBDISTRIB, D-I-S-T-R-I-B. We will be monitoring your most excellent questions and putting them to Ron. Okay? So, very good. NARIBDISTRIB, hashtag NARIBDISTRIB. So where were we?
I think where you might have been going to was you want to make sure if you have a 12-track album on digital and a 10-track album on physical that you're linking them in SoundScan so that you're getting the same sale.
Yes.
There. I think that's what was your point that you were trying to say. So you need to make sure that you're also registering those products as one product and you don't have – otherwise you'll end up with, you know, the title on the chart – or the title twice out there, and you don't get to see the full. If you're going for a distribution deal, you'll have to be explaining, well, look, you know, I actually sold 20,000 units. I sold five of this one, and I sold, and that kind of stuff gets people going like, okay, great. You know, great. I can't really tell what you sold. I'm trying to figure it out here.
Okay.
Very important to link them, link the like products, and so that you get the credit you deserve.
And so, just you said a minute ago, the UPC and the ISRC code are the same for the digital and the physical product, as long as
it's exactly the same.
Exactly the same. Okay.
Music and content, order of track listing. It has to be the exact piece of product.
All right.
If it changes by a second on a track, it's a different piece of product.
Interesting. Okay. Good to know. All right. So, anything else on ISRC codes?
I mean, I think the only thing I will tell you, and I think this is really important because I think we should spend a second on it, just make sure that you stay current on your UPC thing. You can't let that lapse. And it's not cheap. It's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to stay current. I think, didn't Grand South One, aren't they the originator of the UPC code? Does anybody know? Huh? GS1, yeah. Yep. I believe they are, but I would really suggest that you go there and take care of your blocks and keep it current.
Good.
And I think the other question you'd asked that we might not have been clear about was the renewal on the ISRC code so you can get more codes for the next year, right? Right? Because they change them, because you're not supposed to go back and use the old ones. I think that was a question you were sort of asking.
Okay. Good. So, any questions on any of this?
Does that make sense? Is there any clarification there that I missed? Because I know you have a lot of experience in this.
No. All right. So,
accurate?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yes, sir.
So, right now, I'm running everything as independent label, and we use CD Baby, and they assign the SRC codes, right?
Okay.
So, in the future, if we sign a deal with a bigger distributor, and they wanted to release our back catalog, are those SRC codes thrown out?
Hold on. Let me repeat this. So we have an independent label currently going through CD Baby, and he says if we get a deal or
bigger
distribution deal, how does it work when we release our back catalog with the numbers?
ISRC codes live with the track forever. You're fine. It's the UPC code, I think, that's the more cautious piece of it.
Yes.
That you have consistency in the first five digits as your company identifier.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that you also don't depend on some other organization to keep you current.
Right.
Yeah, because that can happen too. If you've gotten your UPC codes through a third party and then they don't keep up their subscription, you lose your codes.
They go out of business. They get disinterested in the business. You know, God forbid, I don't want to see any of those things happen. They decide they're not going to pay it annually because they don't want to for some reason. Those are all risks.
They forgot.
Yeah, that's risk.
David.
It's very important for Charles also to remember, when you do that, it's better not to count on CD Baby in that case to fill out for you the metadata and sign.
No.
Better do it yourself because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You might leave them and go to another company.
Right.
Independent.
Yeah, well, if there's and David here is emphasizing the importance of metadata and not leaving it to a third party like CD Baby or anyone to fill out for you.
Absolutely.
And if there's one thing I've learned in the five years that we've been doing the pitch sessions, it's metadata, metadata, metadata.
Absolutely.
In fact, there have been articles written on it that I have pored over in great detail, how to identify your track when you're pitching it, especially because there are more independent artists than molecules in the universe. And then you add, of course, all of the tracks, the 10, 12, 15 tracks on any major album release. You have a whole bunch of information out there. And the main way in which music is found today is through search. And search is keywords. And keywords is metadata. So metadata is the information that you put, particularly the rights holder information, that you embed into each track. And it's best if you do it yourself, Bowie, so that you know that it's been done right, that you know these numbers are correct. You use your own UPC code if you have it. And any particular keywords, that goes more toward the marketing of the music. But that's helpful, too, with search and discovery. People wanting to find sad dance music, which is the best description of music I've heard recently. Someone who does sad dance music.
Okay.
So, exactly. So metadata, metadata. So to David's point, make sure your metadata is accurate and that you do it yourself, because you're the only one who really knows the ownership and the origin of your own track. What worries me is when we see so many errors in our day-to-day lives, just administrative errors. You get a phone message and the phone number's wrong, or, you know, someone charged you an extra $4 on a bill, or, you know, we tried some Facebook advertising this week and I stopped the campaign and they kept charging. I noticed there was an extra $10 charged. All of these little administrative errors made by other people will affect your ability to be paid, because even a spelling error on the name of the rights holder or the title or some kind of abbreviation or punctuation that should or should not be there, any tiny mistake like that will cause it not to be found or properly attributed, which is what will cause you not to be paid. And sometimes you don't even know that it's happening. All right. Yes. One.
No.
David?
It's just a painful experience so people can learn from.
Okay.
The first 5 years with Orchard, I was extremely busy producing worldwide. And the last thing I want to do is to go through the, you know, whatever the send the statement at the time was not online and see what's going on. Later on, we found out that 13 albums were missing in the metadata. That means I didn't get paid for 13 albums.
Okay.
Now, how are you going to say how much you lost?
So, lesson learned by young David here. He was too busy for 5 years to check his metadata, and 13 albums were lost.
They filled out the metadata.
Okay.
That was the problem.
Okay, they filled out the metadata. All right, so we're going to become briefly intermittent and mourn for the loss of revenue on those 13 albums, David. We'll be back here in about 8.5 minutes, unless Ron has something to say before we break.
I think we should start on the break to talk a little bit about aggregators, because I may have a very different definition than I heard in here, because somebody's saying that CD Baby or TuneCore was an aggregator. I don't see them as aggregators. So there may be one definition that says who's direct with accounts versus indirect. I saw an aggregator as different, as I described to you earlier, and I just think this is important for clarity. As a major independent distributor, I saw aggregators as taking and putting more repertoire through the system through somebody that had one deal. But there may be a definition that's being used in the room, and you've got to clarify me, that it's people who do or don't have a direct deal with, like, an iTunes, right? Or a direct deal with Target, right? So that there's two different definitions. I want to be clear that I was describing it of from a repertoire flow point of view, and maybe we should talk a minute about direct and indirect relationships with retail.
Okay. Do you want to do that before or after the break?
We'll do it after the break.
Okay. Okay, everybody online, stay with us. Make a cup of coffee. We'll be right back with you. We're here for the second half of part one of our GOT distribution lecture and workshop with Ron Spaulding of Spaulding Enterprises, LLC. We're getting a lot of information about what not to do and what to do in order to maximize distribution and be prepared for it and to make the most of it. So we are going to go back and clarify a few things that we touched
Let's
on in part one, including the true definition of aggregator and what one can and cannot expect.
Yes. Let's start there. My definition of aggregator is, like I mentioned before the break, was as a major independent, I wanted to grab artists' repertoire without doing a bunch of different deals. So I would run them through a trusted source that, and even run budgets through there to say, hey, you know, I need X amount of dollars to promote this artist. If I believed in the artist enough, I'd say, okay, XYZ Records, you take the artist and I'm going to feed you some money to make sure that we can get this up and running so that I don't lose the opportunity to put that music out in the marketplace. I think there might have been some confusion in and around that there are aggregators. I think that it's a definition of aggregator. I've never used it like that. But of distribution companies in the marketplace that may not have direct deals with either physical or digital accounts, and they're aggregating content to go through another source. So I won't spend time on trying to define who those are and who those aren't, because I'm not sure I even know. There are hundreds of distributors in the marketplace if you go out and start to search, you know, that especially with this digital world that we live in, that can put your stuff up digitally, and you can do a lot of it yourself too. So you may or may not need that service depending on where you're at.
What are the fee ranges
of what
when you go through CD Baby? What does that cost, Sydney?
$59.
$59 to get uploaded, and then
you're on 84 sites around the world.
Okay. $59, and then you're on 84 sites around the world. For an album?
That's for an album.
For 10 tracks, 10, 12 tracks?
$9.99 for a single.
Okay. $0.99.
$9.99
for a single. Okay.
Is that yearly? It's once.
No, it's one time.
One time only. Okay, $59, one time only fee to get an album onto CD Baby and distributed to 80 sites. Okay.
A couple other pieces of clarification I think that's important is we talked about mechanicals briefly, and I'm no publishing expert, but mechanicals are paid on the manufactured units for physical. The other part that's important too is to make sure that you know that you can do distribution, as most of you know, on your own through lots of different places. We talked a little bit about that briefly. And then you can look for a bigger, more broad deal with a direct relationship in a bigger house as you grow.
Okay. So that would be upstreaming.
No, I consider upstreaming. I consider upstreaming if you have a deal. Let's say you're at Fontana during my time, and one of your records is getting traction. Upstreaming would be send it to one of the wholly owned labels to go and put marketing and promotion and behind that record, and then they'd end up, you'd probably get an override for that.
And an override, explain?
An override would be, you know, a few points on a record that you would take instead of taking all of the 85%, if that was what your royalty rate was to the artist, or whatever your negotiated royalty rate, whatever that rate was, you would just get simply a number, whether that was 3%, 2%, 5%, 10% override of whatever the sales on the net sales on that record would be.
All right, everyone follow? Okay, excellent.
So that the major could take it, spend the real money, use their real promotion team to get it on radio and really blow the record up. Okay. That would be my definition of upstream.
Okay, good. All clear? Anyone eating chocolate has to share. All right, please. Okay. Anything else you want to clarify?
The only last thing, I think I got a little bit confused too about the UPC conversation. So I think what Gene was mentioning, not to speak for you, Gene, but correct me if I'm wrong, is the UPC is on the physical piece of product and also on the physical disc, was what you were talking, not embedded in the physical disc audio file. Correct.
Okay. Oh, I understood that it was embedded in the audio file. It is not. Okay. All right.
I'm sorry if I...
Okay, sorry.
So I just want to make sure that the room was clear on that, because I got a little confused there, too.
Okay, so that's now clear? Good.
I have a small question.
Yes.
If CD Baby charges you $59 to distribute in 85 major distribution sites, if I did it on my own, how much would it cost? Because I think also Tess started that question. What are the fees, for example, to submit to iTunes, to Amazon, to all the other sites? Would you recommend me to do it myself?
They probably won't do a direct deal with everybody out in the marketplace. Yeah. That's you have to have a certain amount of volume. I don't think Amazon would do it at all, but certainly iTunes, I don't know what their standards are.
Because they don't want to have 50,000 single artist accounts. The paperwork and administration on that alone will make you want to jump off a cliff. So, yeah.
So when I'm saying do it on your own, there are services out there that are even different price than CD Baby or TuneCore or some of those that you can go and do it for even less. There's all kinds of options. So you just need to be aware of those options. I think the question is asked there is, what accounts are you direct with specifically, and if you're not direct, then who's servicing those accounts, right? Who's that person that you use? If they're not direct with iTunes, who's selling to iTunes, right? And what are those? What if any are there fees involved in that?
Good question in the back row.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to answer this question. The value of $59. I mean, let's just be real. How much is your time worth? And the amount of work that they get done, the amount of administration, passwords, usernames that they get done for you, not only from other people, but from my own experiences. The amount of time you save by just going through that one channel to get all 85 of those sites plus whatever avenues they've developed, to get all that knocked out, what is your time worth to get all that done for $59?
So the comment is, what is your time worth, and how long would it take you to fill out and get with 80 separate companies? And, you know, that's a question that I ask myself, too. But I would look at what service they really provide, because sometimes, and, you know, in the case of CD Baby, I know it to be perfectly legitimate. But then I know there are other organizations that white label things that they upcharge you for something you could do just as easily yourself. So it is worth paying attention to. So Anything else on that, Ron?
No, I think it goes back to the kind of where we started when we started talking about labels and artist-owned labels and how much work that is. There's no reason that you shouldn't use expertise where you can find it. And people that are typically in the space, be it CD Baby or somebody else, and they're servicing 80 accounts, are probably pretty good at it. They probably do it, you know, on a regular daily basis, and they have a lot more experience, presumably, than somebody that's supposed to be recording great music every day. And not always the case, but I like to kind of compartmentalize experience and go do what you do great and let somebody else do what they do great so that you can really grow.
Yeah, I agree. So let's get to distribution, staff, and structure. I think it's important to know who does what at these distribution companies so that you know who to call and ask questions or where's my sales report, what's going on in the Northwest, why aren't we selling, you know, that sort of thing. So walk us through sort of the typical departments of a distribution company and who does what.
Well, you know, my best experience of when I was at Fontana, which again I consider like a major independent, right? I had it structured like this. You had a head of the company that was responsible for the overall view of the company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a head of finance that was responsible for all the finance functions, mm-hmm. and was also very involved because finance is very involved in deal making.
Mm-hmm.
So running scenarios and deals and P&Ls against opportunities that we were considering.
Mm-hmm.
We had a head of legal, so mm-hmm. we had somebody to do contracts and do all the legal stuff. And then I had a head of marketing, and I had a head of actually of gospel and Christian, mm-hmm. because I thought that was a specialized enough business with a little bit of a different set of stores and et cetera that serviced that mm-hmm. at that time. And then we had product managers they weren't called product managers. We had what we called label managers that worked for the marketing department. And that was your day-to-day person to contact for anything. And they were each assigned about 10 labels apiece, give or take, 10 to 12
labels.
So
are you using label manager and product manager interchangeably?
Product managers, by my definition, are at mm-hmm. a label.
Okay.
And they are responsible for the liaison of all mm-hmm. the parts in pieces between the project and the company.
Okay.
That's what a product manager does in a label that I'm familiar with, and a label manager manages the label because you're supposed to have as a label the product management under control. And so they would be your point of contact for anything that you wanted, and it got escalated to any of those other departments should you need to take it up. I mean, you're partners with these guys, so you can pick up the phone and call the head of the company, you can call the head of legal, you can call, you know, head of finance if you have a finance question. But that label manager in that structure was the liaison and typically went down to finance and said, hey, I've got label XYZ and, you know, they've got questions on their statements and here's all their questions. Can we get this back to them? And then they just make sure you had one point of contact.
What were your field staffing operations at Fontana?
We had our own national accounts managers at that time, and then we had we were using UMGD, their sales staff for mm-hmm. the heavy lifting out there. So
okay.
they were selling the product day to day, and we had our own relationship with the national accounts. So when it got sub national accounts, you know,
okay,
we handled that.
All right, so those are the main functions, really.
It is, and every one of these companies is structured a little bit differently mm-hmm. and has some nuances in around what I just described. Right.
But I think an important recommendation is if you are considering distribution or indeed if you have distribution to go in and introduce yourself to everybody. And I will tell you that when I worked at a major label, I can remember two artists who came through and played for everyone at the company, which I thought was really cool. Really cool. And of the hundreds of artists that we had, I still remember to this day that Bobby Brown bought everyone a very expensive bottle of champagne when he got a number one, and he came through and delivered it personally. Very nice. Tom Petty had a number one, and he sent massive bouquets of flowers to the head of every department. So, I mean, I wasn't the head of a department. I'm like, oh, well, that's nice. And then we had a band called A House on the label that came through and did a little lunchtime performance. I thought that was the smartest thing ever. Why don't more artists do that? You know, so come through and introduce yourselves. To, you know, go through and talk to the distributor that you're considering working with. and definitely go to meet with them when you are working with them. That's how Madonna really made her break. She was spending time with the head of every major department at Warner Brothers long before she had her Like a Virgin breakthrough. She knew everything that was going on, and when she hit hard, because everyone at that label knew her and wanted her to succeed. It is so important and so rarely done.
We're still in an image business, and I think that part of that branding and imaging of that is doing that for yourself as an executive, as an artist, in your craft. And honestly, in my tenure at Fontana, you know, we encourage the artists to come in. We wanted the label to bring their artists in. We wanted to get our staffs enthused about it. And when they were on the road, we wanted them to stop by and see the people in the field. And, you know, it's just like anything else. If you feel like you have a personal relationship with somebody, you probably go an extra half a step when it comes to getting things done than if it's somebody that you just don't know at all. So you got to work the building. You got to work your project. You got to work your image and your branding efforts just as if you were talking to consumers. You know, people pay attention to that.
Yeah, very much so. So I want to look at some of the major retailers that you included for us here, Ron, on page, I think it's...
I got to get out seven, your
eight.
Sheet here.
Yeah, all right. Gotcha. Page 8, I believe. Yeah. Page 8. So I extrapolated from some materials that Ron sent me, some of the major retail chains that are still important to have on the radar, still selling lots and lots of units, and the military accounts, which I think is really interesting and important and often overlooked by people who are unfamiliar with all the possibilities of distribution. The military accounts you have here, what are they called?
Europac and Softland.
Softland. What is that exactly? Those are the distributors that send out music to the troops?
No, the PXs, the stores, PXs, and
okay.
are the commissaries, if you will, that are on the military bases.
Okay.
And you have a pretty captive audience there for physical specifically because, you know, that's where they go to get essentially everything from food to clothes to...
Mm-hmm.
Is that globally or nationally?
It can be global. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, so they can have global, it's national or global. What's interesting, too, is the, I forget the exact acronym for the organization, they take bands around the world to perform for the troops. And they pay a modest stipend. It's not huge, but they do pay all expenses. So they pay travel, food, and again, you're playing for a captive audience, and if you really work it and put on a dynamite performance... That's money in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really great way to go.
And they have all kinds of, you know, welcome home things for people that are coming mm-hmm. back from serving overseas and et cetera, mm-hmm. you know, that they're coming into port and stuff and or you know, especially on the ships. So we've done events to entertain them and put our brand out there in front of them too.
Which is great. So wholesalers, and then you have here VMI. What is VMI?
I'm not sure what that is. Vendor management services.
Vendor management services.
But wholesalers and one stops is probably what that should read because you still have one stops like Alliance down in Florida.
Okay, and a one stop. Can you define a one stop?
One stops. Let's stay with Alliance in Florida. They are and it's they're now owned by Super D, which is actually out in Southern California. They got purchased very recently. And they're a very big one-stop. And what they do is they sell lots and lots and lots of music to independent accounts particularly because that prevents the majors from being open with same as we're talking about distribution. It narrows their pipe. They're selling one account that's selling a lot of smaller accounts. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily smaller. I mean, Alliance Services, Barnes & Noble, and they'll do a lot of fill-in for major retailers on the physical side. And they also provide quite an array of digital services for certain accounts there too. Yeah. So... the one-stops have changed over the years. It used to be just simply selling independent stores, and now they've gotten much more broad than that. So wholesalers like Anderson selling to Walmart, right, is what I want you to be clear about it. They're called rack jobbers in the old days, right, and selling into Anderson. You sell a product to Anderson, and Anderson sells it to Walmart stores.
Okay, so wholesaler is a rack jobber. And is everybody here familiar with the independent coalitions, like SIMS?
Let me stop you for one quick second. Okay. The reason the name Rack Jobber was there too was because they actually send physical salespeople into the stores to put the CD on the rack. So that's the reason that someone like Walmart uses Anderson, is so that they don't have to have their personnel constantly, you know, trying to get a department that has a lot of SKUs and a lot of categorization services. So they send them in once, twice, multiple times a week around the holidays to actually perform that service of taking the stock out of the back room, putting it on a shelf, categorizing it, keeping the department neat. Mm-hmm. So it reduces their own overhead as a retailer, and they pay them a fee to do that.
Okay.
Yep.
So the indie coalitions?
The indie coalitions are still alive and well. You have Ames, Sims, Nira. They are a collection of stores that have banded together of independent stores that have banded together to market and promote releases collectively. So they have programs in place that you can participate in, that either listing stations or branding programs that affect a number of stores. And instead of it being one independent store, now all of a sudden they function as a 120 store chain. And that was the idea behind the coalition.
And so when you're working to get your product into the marketplace, one of the things that you can do is pay for placement. So you can pay to get on an end rack or on a listing station or a display ad of your artist or whatever it is. And I guess going through these independent coalitions enables you to get a little bit more bang for your buck.
Yeah, it ends up they end up coming together and making a little bit more leverage possible for them with the providers of content or the distributors. So instead of coming in as each individual store and negotiating to get a listing station or a feature in their publication that they send out or any of those things, they're saying we have 120 stores instead of it just one store having that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're aggregating both marketing costs and purchases.
Which is
so
smart.
They'll make a commitment to say, you know, we'll support you at this level if you do these kind of programs with us typically. And some of them still buy through one stops out there. So, you know, you can still manage your purchases because you can see what the one-stops are buying.
Okay, good.
At the time I was with the Super D, and they still didn't have Alliance, they didn't buy much. So they had their own catalog. They would provide also this kind of location or organization as a co-op. So they can put ad in their own catalog that they're releasing.
Okay, so Super D... David was doing co-op advertising with them.
Right.
Yes. Describe what co-op advertising is.
Well, and what you're describing is they have a new release book,
right,
or a flyer, if you will. So the major independent distribution company sends out, or the distribution company would send out a new release book to their customer base that's
right,
direct with them, right? And so the non-direct accounts that were going through a Super D, for example, would get a separate release book that would have all of the product from all, you know, the majors would all send, you know, Universal, Sony, a Warner book would come out, the other independent distribution companies would have a book, ADA, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, these guys, and where you were paying for placement and exposure, was to get features and like a one sheet into the book that went out to the retailers that weren't necessarily direct or might have bought some of their purchases indirectly through a one-stop instead of through the major.
They charge you,
so that's
they
co-op.
Deducted from your sales.
Okay.
Yeah, and well, that's one form of co-op of exposure. The other form of co-op is paying for a circular ad,
right,
the newspaper ads, or paying for placement on an end cap where you would pay a fee that to be placed at retail, and you would pay a fee to be in the circular or get considered for the circular, those kind of things. There's other POP sales, whether it was, you know, merchandising in the store or you know, the TVs. There's Walmart TV and stuff like that to get your videos played on there and those kind of things. So there's lots of opportunities to spend money for exposure.
Lots you can pay for.
There's
lots of
opportunities to spend money.
One of my friends who's an artist manager said, if you think the margins are thin, in the music business, try being in the grocery store business.
Oh, I hear.
Yeah. So, you know, where product placement is so key, because, you know, they do thousands of studies. If it's at eye level, people will buy more, you know, because we're too lazy to lean down. All of that stuff adds up, but placement is really important.
And digital is a little bit different. So if you take Apple, for example, they don't charge for their placement there. They simply are trying to provide content for consumers that they think is most motivating for them and for their consumers, or expanding their consumer base. Sometimes you'll see them take and put not the biggest selling record in the front of the page, but they'll put something in there that they feel like will either generate more customers and more exposure for them and bring other people into their store or their streaming service. So they'll do features in and around things that they really want to push and create excitement about. But you don't pay for that.
Which is nice. Take it if you can get it. So, digital accounts, some of the top ones are listed here. Some of them are obvious. Some of perhaps not quite so obvious, like Verizon. Now, is RDO still... I thought they went bankrupt, or are they still...
Yeah, they're not. They're shutting...
Shutting down.
Down,
right.
Or being sold, or something's happening with
okay.
RDO.
So, here are some of the top digital accounts, and... you know, with Apple iTunes, we know they don't take independent artists directly, but you can go through someone like CD Baby. TuneCore, I think, goes. Mm-hmm. They have a deal with iTunes as well. So some of those things to consider. And all right, so those are some of the top retailers. Very good. Have any questions? We're taking questions, by the way. If you want to tweet questions from anywhere in the universe, hashtag NARIPDistrib. If you get any brilliant ones, Bowie, just let me know. All right. So, Ron, what has changed the most in the last 5 years of distribution?
Oh, my. There's been so many changes. I mean, the most pronounced change that we're also so aware of is the shift of where consumers really want to participate in getting music. We've seen a lot of that transition by configuration. As you know, we went from vinyl to cassette to 8-track, I think. I don't remember any of that, Gene, but we went from vinyl to 8-track to cassette to CD. And I remember when the CD first came out, and that was going to be the final frontier, because the quality and the fact that it was digital, and there was nothing more to be gained. And then all of a sudden, you know, we have downloads and we have streaming, and there's a dramatic shift to streaming, as you're seeing that people are moving more and more away from ownership and more into on demand when they want to get it, where they want to get it. And it's so portable, right?
And what are the major distributors doing? You said over 50% of their revenue is coming from streaming.
I sum up some of them that is the case, and certainly on a per project basis, it can sometimes be higher than that, frankly. But that there's still a pipeline to distribute and to service Spotify and service, you know, Apple Music and those places, and that's no different than the pipeline that existed before. They want to have, you know, that data on payments and that run back and forth between fewer partners, not thousands and thousands of partners. And when you look at streaming data, it's seriously cumbersome. It's very, very, very large volumes of reports, and presumably you want somebody to pore over those besides you.
Yeah, and
figure out how people get paid,
and what to do with the data.
Right.
So, what can people here do to better approach a distributor and/or work with a current distribution situation to maximize their sales and coverage?
I think. Well, two questions. One, how do you maximize your sales and coverage? You create demand, and you make sure that the distributor that you're working with is taking advantage of that demand that you've created. Whether that's in a certain zip code, or whether that's nationally, or whether it's globally, you know, you want to make sure that when your efforts are put forward in both monetarily or sweat equity, or however you're putting your efforts forward, that you're maximizing the opportunity for revenues in and around that. So communicating, making sure that the distributor understands where your efforts are going to be, not only where they are, because they're easy to see week to week if you're being successful, but what your anticipated plan is, mm-hmm. where you're going, so that they can get in front of it, both with, you know, requesting featuring at digital service providers or, you know, playlisting, et cetera, to coincide with your marketing plan. I think that's really key in increasing your revenues.
Do you help people write marketing plans?
No.
Why not?
It's not my expertise.
Okay.
I can certainly help you with your marketing plan, but I don't want to write any marketing plans. I can help you if you so choose that in direction. I think it starts. I always tell people this that I've worked with for years and years and years is, where do you want to end up? And 9 times out of 10, people want to get a diamond award, right? They want to be 11 times, you know, 10 plus times platinum, and I don't blame. But realistically, where do we want to end up? What does that timeline look like? You know, when do you really want to end up there? What's reality? And then what's it going to take to get there? And then do we have the elements in place? Do we have the resources? Do we have the muscle? Do we have the talent in the artists that we're working with to be able to really go and hit our goals? Mm-hmm. And then you back into the plan. That's how I would do it, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes people say, hey, I want to sell 50,000 units. Okay. Well, you know, we may not start selling 50,000 units, but maybe that's going to take us a year. Maybe that's going to take us 18 mm-hmm. months. So we need to now budget and put a timeline together to make sure we don't run out of resources to get us there before you get where you want to go. Mm-hmm.
So I think the best marketing plan has 3 simple elements: your goals, where do you want to end up, money, and time. All right? Usually you will have more than one of the other. If you're an independent artist, you probably have slightly more time than money. Labels struggle with this too, where you're going to put your resources. But I actually do help people write marketing plans, so it's not hard, but it does take a little bit of expertise. And I think someone who is objective about your goals and what your opportunities in the marketplace might be is sometimes good to look, you know, good to talk to. So you had a question, my dear.
Yeah, I was wondering, you had said that you'd only done like a handful of direct distribution deals to artists. What were the variables with those particular artists that made you do that deal?
Okay, the question is, Ron says he's done only a few direct to artist distribution deals. What were the variables that caused him to go with
what
it?
What inclined him to do that?
What were the variables that inclined you to go with those?
You know... Usually the artists that I would do a direct deal with really had some momentum and had that early. So, for example, you know, exposure on a TV show, I did a direct deal. I'll keep specifics out of it, names, so that nobody feels weird. But I did a deal one time with an artist that was coming off a major TV show. It was a music-based TV show, so they were getting a tremendous amount of action. And I said, hey, you know, this is a brand that they already have a brand, and they've got real momentum off this TV show, so it's somebody I want to be in business with, and they just wouldn't do a deal with somebody else. They wanted it to be a standalone deal, and if I didn't do it, they were going to go and get a deal somewhere else. So I felt compelled that I wanted to lock that repertoire down instead of it going to my so-called competitor, which I don't think there's any competition in life if you're the best at what you do. But regardless of that, that's a philosophy I've always had. If you're great at what you do and you worry about what you do, the rest of the marketplace will take care of itself. But long story short, I've also had other artists, like, you know, if there was somebody coming off of at, you know, American Idol or The Voice or something like that. Not always. If you had great radio and you had great, you know, great socials, if I could look at the socials and look at your YouTube views and look at, you know, your Twitter and your Instagram and see that you had real, you know, on your Facebook, you have real likes and that it wasn't manufactured, right? Because you can manufacture some of that stuff too. And if I could look at it and feel like there was really a real base there, you look at it and it's a math equation, right? If there's, you know, 100 million views on YouTube, and I felt like I could get 1% of them to go in.
What's the bare minimum for, like, expectation on, I guess, following?
the what's the bare minimum of expectations for social?
I've had people tell me with YouTube, it's like you should aim to have 200,000 followers to be paying your bills off YouTube.
Followers or views?
Followers, like so, it's consistency of views.
You know, I mean, I don't really know what the exact number is of where you would break even on there. I'd be leading you astray. But what I do know from a distribution point of view is I was looking for the more grand number, and I didn't have necessarily a minimum. And again, I may be an old school record guy because mine was a gut play, mm-hmm. right? I felt like if I had executives and artist talent in the same place, that executives that could go and execute and actually get something done and actually create demand, and I had really great repertoire and really great artists that I felt was talented and committed to it. Because I would sometimes bring artists into the office and just say, you know, I can't want this more than you do, right? Like, if I'm the hardest working guy in the relationship, we're going to fail. So you got to really be ready to go do this. I don't want to get too far off track, but this will hopefully be interesting and sort of answer your question, maybe not. I had an A-list artist that was a friend of mine. And at that time, he wanted to change genres. And the genre that he wanted to change was more of a, you know, he wanted to come out of a different genre and he wanted to go into rock. And the conversation was, you got to smell like a rock band, right? If you really want to be in a rock business, that means you got to go play clubs and you got to go get in a van and put your guitar in the van. And, you know, sometimes people are going to show up, sometimes people aren't. And you've got to grind it out. If you really want to be a real rock band, because there's a credibility issue there when you go to talk to that community, that they want to make sure that it's something that's real. It's not just fake. And I'm going to do it. I did the deal, and after I think we did two or three dates, he was done with that. You know, he had a pretty decent lifestyle from other stuff that he was doing, you know, and that whole band thing didn't look so sexy after about three stops in it. So, you know, I honestly think I can't speak for the other people in this space. I can only speak for how I would choose to manage the business. It's a combination of gut, looking at the social numbers now is really, really critically important, and seeing that there's some trajectory for some growth. Right, that it's not maxed out and that it's not old and stale and that there's still a chance for some real upside, because typically it involves, you know, at that level, you typically somebody needs money. They want the distributor to write a check.
And how do the distributors do that from time to time?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely. And most of the advances in the distribution business are either on the established side. I think that's still the case. Or catalog side, that they, you know, if I was doing it, again, I don't want to speak for the people that are current in the space because I don't want to offend them, but if I was doing it, I'd look at catalog sales and say, I know I'm spending this much revenue off of it annually. I can give this much money against that revenue and still be okay if it implodes tomorrow. Or I would look at an established artist or two that was on the roster that they have, and I'd look at something that was the last 18 months or 24 months sound scan, and I can pretty much put a number to it, right? I can pretty much know how I can make money, how much I can do it. Because, again, advances are loans. Mm-hmm. I'm expecting to recoup it. It's money that's going to be due the label anyway or the artist. It's just me betting on that I'm going to get it back, and it's going to sell exactly what we think it is.
Okay. What are some of the biggest mistakes people make when entering into distribution deals?
I think the biggest mistake is that they see the distribution company as a label. I think that's the first biggest mistake, is that they think that the distribution company is going to provide the things that you really have to provide, which is the demand creating business and the back end part of it, and making sure your ISRC codes and your operation side of it, that ISRC codes are done, right? You need to take responsibility for your own business. And if you entrust other people to do that, I think it's dangerous. But that's really the first biggest mistake that I see people making, is they think that somebody else is going to do the work for them, and they're not. The other mistake they make, especially when you're talking about major independent distribution houses, is honestly you have to work the building. You have to make sure that you're a priority and that you're not just crying wolf, right? Because if you cry wolf 45 times, the next time you pick a phone call, they don't take you seriously. But you got to make sure you're using that relationship to drive your initiatives when you really have an initiative to drive. And you got to know the difference, right? Sometimes passion won't get it all the way there.
Nope, it's got to be work. And I love what you said, don't cry wolf.
Too many times. You can do it once or twice.
Right. Instead of wolf. I'm just having fun with you. All right.
What did I say, wolves?
You said wolf instead of...
Oh, wolf. Wolf.
Instead, don't cry wolf.
Wolf. Is that my accent?
I don't
Wait a minute. You mean wolf like the dog instead of wolf like the animal?
There is... Yeah.
Right. I'm sorry, Tess. I had to do that.
My dad's from the South, so I'm not making fun. Okay.
I've taken it personally. I'm offended.
Please don't.
Just kidding.
Do we have any questions from the Twittersphere, Bowie? Any genius, brilliant?
Not at this stage.
Okay. All right.
No.
We're taking
just clarification on "Don't Cry Wolf" at this stage.
Whose side are you on? Yeah.
Okay. Do we have any questions?
You know, I was kind of just curious, this might be kind of an esoteric question, but like how do you feel that like vinyl is starting to play back into distribution? Because I personally, I buy it on a regular basis, and I'm not just used. I go particularly a lot of the time Amazon, sometimes I'll check over Amoeba. But so how do you feel like that's playing in the new world? Does it matter?
Okay, I think people,
let me repeat the question. Whoops. Question from Ezra. How do you feel about the resurgence of vinyl?
I think it's very real and it's exciting because it's one of the categories that's really growing. It's a configuration that's really growing, and it's a configuration that, you know, I was around when we killed it. You know, at one point, you know, we looked at it and said, oh, you know, sales are shrinking. We did the same thing with cassettes. You know, sales are shrinking. Things are. Now let's do away with that. We're going to put all our eggs over here, and I think that that's natural, right? You see a configuration growing like digital, and now you see people going like this to CDs and stuff. There's still a decent CD business, still decent physical business out there, and vinyl is exciting. I think it's exciting because I think a lot of the new generations are discovering it for the very first time, and it's unique and it has big pictures on it and you know. Lyrics oftentimes and things that you can play with that they can't hold anywhere else, right? And I think it's super exciting. And I think that the record companies that I'm dealing with are excited about it.
Okay. Yes, David.
Besides that issue of retro, there's also another issue. People are getting tired of, especially the younger generation, realizing MP3 is a compressed file, whereas analog is a whole different world.
Rich, yes. Rich sounds.
So, but there's also another element into that, and it has to do with the segmentation within this society that's going after that.
Mm-hmm.
Urban, older crowd also, and they have also the money to pay for that, because mm-hmm. you go to Whole Foods and you see Don Henley, for example, $45 for LP.
You're kidding.
New Don Henley?
Yeah.
Wow.
$45.
Nice.
So you got to
have that
the dough to pay, you know?
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah,
wow.
I'm serious.
So David Yacobian says that apart from the retro element, we've got a lot of people who are getting tired of MP3s and realizing the compressed sound doesn't really give you the rich experience of an album. I love my album, so there. So Ron, give us an overview of your organization, what you can do to help people with their distribution needs.
I mean, what I've really been doing as a consultant in this space is looking for opportunities to help people grow their brand. And in the distribution world, I've just simply been liaising between the distributor or creating the deal. I did a deal last year for a partner of mine. And we negotiated the deal, and then I'm liaising between the artist and the distributor. The other thing that I have pending, and I won't name the company yet, but I've been telling Gene this since July because I kind of soft-pedaled it because I haven't signed an artist yet or or did anything. But I also have a deal that I'm just on the brink of inking for myself. And we'll put out some artists there, and we'll also probably provide some of those opportunities for some select labels out there that we would want to aggregate through our system. So,
and what type of what genre, if any, or
I want great genres. I'm okay. Just gonna say. I want great, exciting genres. But I mean, I think for the first part of this for us, I've spent a lot of time in the urban music business, and and I have a passion for it. So I think
you and Brian.
Yes, Brian and I. Yep,
Brian Shafton, RBC Records.
Brian's done a great job. He's got a great company, and he's done a great job in that space. But I think, you know, Urban AC. We might touch a little bit of gospel in that regard. We'll definitely touch some rap stuff, and then I think alternative is probably the next venture for us.
Will you be hiring?
We will. We'll probably aggregate. Some services on the front end of it,
okay.
which you know, there's plenty of great independent people out there that I'm friendly with that can help us build it in the short term, you know, in the social media space and some of those areas. You know, certainly won't have an in-house lawyer day one, and
all right,
we'll outsource that
stuff.
Well,
if your network doesn't provide all the right people, let me know and we'll help you find
great
someone.
Great. Okay. I'm sure you can help us there, but we're very close. In fact, I would suspect we'll be done by mid-March and be in play. So not to push that service on you, but those are two things, or to help grow your brand and your relationship in the business in general. I'm proud of being able to help there as well.
Gospel and Christian, you mentioned. Tell us about those genres and how those are doing. Do we find that people in those markets still buy more physical product on average than other genres?
Well, Christian's a little bit different. Contemporary Christian, I'm probably not going to play in that space as much. The answer is that yes, Urban AC particularly I like because it's got a little older demographic and it's physical and it's been great. And I've had great experience in that space with real great physical sales. And digital is growing, but it's in my experience with the few projects that I've touched there, it's been less than 50%, which I like. And then in the alternative side, it's just the opposite. I mean, I think that's an exciting genre, and that sometimes can be 80% digital. So. To answer your question directly, yes, there's a little bit more excitement on the physical side for gospel and urban AC.
Okay. So, your question?
I think if, just as an insight for people, if as a songwriter or as an artist, you just want to be just another rock and roll or what have you, with the same themes, people are tired of it. I think there's a kind of a tendency now going back, like in the 60s, that the substance was really the kernel issue. That was just the same love song that everybody repeating, the same tomorrow, sorrow, and so forth. So, and I think as an insight, if we're going to listen to that, if you take that and stay out of the crowd, you have a bigger chance. And attaching yourself to a cause, even better, because then you have the support of a big brother that can support you through that. Do you agree, Ron?
Yes.
So the comment from David is people are tired of the same old. It's got to be unique, obviously, right. And if you can attach to a cause, all the better, because then you can have the support, hopefully, of an overarching cause or concept or organization. And it reminds me of Tammy Wynette, her famous line about what does it take to succeed in the music business, and she summed it up beautifully. She said you have to be the first, the best, or different, and you have the best shot of being different than you do at being the first or the best.
Absolutely.
Which is really, really hard. It's possible, but being different is the most important.
Yep. I think great is important. I think, you know, too many times, especially in this where the gatekeepers have kind of lessened and that anybody can put music out anywhere, there's a lot of choices. I don't think average or okay is good enough. I think it's got to be great. And it can't just be great because you made it. It has to be great because a bunch of other people think it's great. And that's often where the emotion gets separated in this business. And those are hard conversations, especially with artists. And I have a lot of them as friends. And I love that because I'm not an artist. And that creativity and that I'm really fascinated by that, especially songwriters, because it's not something that I do. And I think it's something that speaks so loudly to a lot of experiences I've had. And they eloquently put it into words and to music. I think that's a beautiful process. Can't get caught up in that. It's got to be something that and by the way, you can do it as a labor of love. It's just hard to make money sometimes if it's only labor of love, right? Great will make you money because there'll be a bunch of other people that step up and go, I support that because I can feel it too, mm-hmm. You know? And it is lots about feeling. We've talked a little bit about it here where you're asking me direct questions about how I did deals. I'm old school, man. I did it on gut, and I either believed in it or I didn't, in all due respect. And thank God at that time, you know, a lot of stuff that we believed in was very successful. So it kept us in a viable situation. But that's really what I did. I mean, I did a deal with a songwriter one time that wrote a song that I put in. I'll just tell you who it is. It's a guy by the name of Mark Tanner, and he wrote a song called Wherever You Will Go that was a big AC hit. I put that song in, you'll think this is crazy, I put that in my playlist to be played at my funeral. Hopefully that's not tonight. And because I just thought it was a great song for my kids, in all due respect. And I was very emotional. I met this guy at lunch, and you can call him up and ask him. He's a friend of mine to this day. And I saw him at lunch, and he said, I'm a songwriter. I said, well, what kind of song songs have you written? You know, because I had met him through a friend, and he said he was looking for a distribution deal. He said, I wrote this song. He had a company by the name of Chime Music. He'll be proud that I'm doing this online. Okay. And he said, you know, I wrote this song that was recorded by The Calling. It's called Wherever You Will Go. And I looked at him, and I said, well, meeting's over. You got the deal. We just got to work out the details. I didn't even know what he had to offer. He was like, no, you don't want to know about the label? I was like, nope. He thought I was kidding. So 3 days later, we had a distribution deal done, you know, because I really believed that was good enough for me. And I don't think it gets done like that very often, but that was definitely my passion of looking for a way to be in business. And he's a great guy, but he wrote one of the greatest songs to me that spoke to me.
Very good way to do it. So,
can I do one thing before we go on?
Sure.
I had to look up this mechanical royalty thing because I didn't want to leave here without defining this since I'm not in publishing. It says, in a nutshell, and this is coming off of CD Baby's website, so if they're wrong, we're going to blame them, okay? right? And I've never worked there, so I respect them, but if they're wrong, then it's wrong. In a nutshell, every time a song you've written is manufactured to be sold in a CD, downloaded on a digital music retail site, or streamed through a service like Spotify, or they have RDO in here, you owed a mechanical royalty.
You are owed, yes.
You are owed a mechanical royalty as a, you know, so that would seem to start to define how mechanicals are paid to me.
Yeah, and that's part of the ongoing class action suit. Two class action suits being waged against Spotify right now is non-payment because they say they don't know who the rights holders are. So, big problem. Somebody without ISRC codes, undoubtedly. David, yes.
And other people have to be very careful about that. When you go to sign any deal, especially like back in Orchard, mm-hmm. I was not aware of it, but they will sign you since you're the artist and also label as one package. And that way they don't have to pay you also mechanical. In other words, you have to pay yourself because you are the label, and the label is supposed to pay the mechanical. So be very careful, guys.
Okay, wait. All right. So if I understood correctly, when you signed with the Orchard to distribute, they signed you as both the artist and the label? They
right.
put it together?
And
what they should have done is signed you separately?
Absolutely. Because, listen to it, I come to them as a label, right?
Right.
So they're making a deal with Worldwide Success Media.
Right.
Okay? They don't know David. They could care less who's David. And so when you come to them later on and say, hey, where's my mechanical, you know? You say, what mechanical? You say, I'm supposed to get mechanical. No. You have to pay yourself because you have the label. So be careful with that they don't put you on the one.
Ron, what do we do?
Say it again. I was just making sure on the mechanical words.
Okay, let me repeat it. Okay. When signing to distributor, make sure that the label is not combined with the artist.
Let me go back. I was approached by the Orchard to sign up with them. And they offered me $120,000 as Worldwide Success Media.
Okay.
Okay? Fine. I did a deal with them. Thank God I was smart enough to do it as a two separate accounts, which really saved me. But they signed you as a label.
Okay. Now, but that's what a distributor typically does.
Now, but the one who's paying the mechanical to the artist, it's a via the record company. So you got to be very careful about it. That, you know, they have their own wording, the way they put it. I don't have exactly the way they put it.
Okay.
They lock me in as if I'm not getting the mechanical through them.
Okay, so for some reason, David did not get the mechanical royalties that he should have received.
Well, the in my opinion, the mechanical royalties, and again, let's just be clear, it's for reproduction of physical song, not whether it's sold or not. Digital, obviously, in streaming, there has to be an action, right? So the label is ultimately responsible for paying mechanicals
exactly.
and publishing royalties.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Because they're presumably getting the bulk of the revenue and they're paying a royalty to the artist.
Right.
In the notes, I think it says artist. If the artist does not have a label, they're still responsible for paying the mechanical royalties, right? The royalty system doesn't change regardless of, you know, if you reproduce the song, you need to pay the royalty. And there's a performance royalty if it's, you know, as well that we can. I'm not an expert on publishing, but it's complex. But you have to pay those fees regardless. And people get in trouble because they don't pay them. And then somebody knocks on the door and says, oh, by the way, you produced 10,000 CDs. Well, you owe me 9.1 cents per each one of those 10,000 CDs that has my song on it.
Okay.
And if there's 10 songs on there, you can do the math.
Thank you, David. Mick, you had a question?
I just was, when the transition to digital came into being, I was under the impression that the reason the mechanical is all in, it was to help expedite the transition. So when the recording industry and the technology business got together to decide how it was going to be done, they made it an all-in deal directly to the artist.
When you say all-in deal, what do you mean
by
that?
Instead of the mechanical being separated and paid, you know, like the label would pay it separate, the digital download store is sort of acting as the label at the point where it's fixed to a physical thing, which is the digital download. And normally they would be the person to pay. But instead of doing that to help expedite the transition, they negotiated so that it was paid back to whoever delivered it to them. So instead of, you know, because when the label fixes a song on a CD, they're the ones responsible for paying the mechanical. But they don't have to separate it out. iTunes doesn't have to separate it out and be responsible for paying it. They pay it back to...
I think I understand, but it's no different if it's physical or digital, right? So you're selling as a distributor, you're selling them at a wholesale price, right? Right, whatever that is. If we're talking about downloads and CDs, we're selling them at a wholesale price of X amount of dollars for the album. Let's say it's $7 on digital and it's, you know, $8 on physical. Let's just use that for this purpose. If that's the case, the label still has to pay mechanicals on each one of those sales and each one of the CDs that's reproduced. So the retailer will not be responsible for that. That'll go back to who holds the rights that has to pay it.
So it is kind of similar.
Yeah, we may be saying the same thing, but you know, because of my accent, I'm not that smart. You know what I mean? So I have to make sure I break it down in simple terms.
Now, Ron. Okay.
So, in his case, where he's the artist and the label, how is that different? I mean,
The artist and the label.
Right. So they're paying the label part of your company.
By the way, it's not just the orchard. Super did the same thing.
Okay, David, hold on.
It's your business.
You guys, let's get clear on this, because you were paid exactly what, or what were you not paid, David?
Okay, I think to understand the big picture, we should see the structure. The orchard has a deal with iTunes, for example, right?
Okay, the orchard has a deal with iTunes.
Yes. iTunes paying Orchard 70%.
iTunes is paying the Orchard 70%.
So on a song, they're paying 70 cents.
Right.
Okay? Now, that's how the spreadsheet goes when you receive that from Orchard. And then you have, that's called gross. And then you have the net. So according to the deal that you have with Orchard, in my case, was 20-80. In other words, 80% goes to me, 20% goes the fee for Orchard, right? So the net would be now 80% from that 70 cents, which
okay.
would be 56 cents.
Okay.
I'm supposed to get 56 cents
okay.
per song. Now, what I do with this 56 cents, it's my problem. If I have a song, for example, with somebody else, I have to pay them.
Right.
Publishing, mechanical, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Performing, everything. Now, if it's me, for example, then they say, you have to pay yourself.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
So, iTunes pays 70%
yes.
to the Orchard.
It's called gross.
Okay, that's the gross. And then out of that, David had an 80-20 deal with the Orchard. So out of the 70 cents, he got 56 cents, 80% of the 70, out of which he would have had to pay any mechanicals or other writers.
Exactly.
But the Orchard said, we're not paying you a mechanical. David, you have to pay yourself.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Interesting. I've got to look into that and make sure that I am clear on this.
Mechanicals included in that.
Well,
yes.
That's where I think
that's right.
The difference is.
Well, right.
Well,
so, are you the label?
I am the label.
And the artist?
You're
the two entities.
You're supposed to pay yourself the mechanical. That's your point.
Exactly.
And that's the way it's structured today.
Again,
and again, we may have to have a thing. I'm not a foregone expert on publishing.
Yeah.
Okay? I want to go on record and say that for the third time, because I've had to look some of this up, okay, just to make sure I don't misquote myself in this room.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are the artist and the label, you are still supposed to pay yourself a mechanical royalty.
Exactly.
That's the way it's structured.
Right.
Now, I guess... That's an accounting exercise because you're getting the proceeds and the in this country, I think what you were saying, that the retailer is paying a wholesale fee and the mechanical royalties are included in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's then the label's job to separate that out of the wholesale payment and
sure.
pay the mechanical. Outside in some, if not many, foreign countries, right? The retailer holds back and pays to collection society. So I think you may be saying that here they rolled it in so that it came from the retailer back. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And out ex-US, that's often not the case. Oftentimes the retailer
mm-hmm.
is handling the payment to the collection societies.
All right.
Is that a little bit more clear? And if I misquoted the publishing thing, you're going to have to get a publisher up here to make sure that it goes proper.
Well, we have just a few minutes left, so do we have any questions? No questions. All right, yes, sir.
Listen, having acknowledged that you've seen the transition in the music industry several times over, where do you think it's going? Like, in the next
five? Okay.
Oh, gosh.
You just preempted my closing question, but we can go with that. What's the future of the music industry and of distribution?
No easy questions in this room. I was kidding when I first met you guys. I said, ask tough questions, and I didn't know we were going to go down mechanical royalties, and now what's the future of the business? Well, if I could guess it, I'd be very, very wealthy, but... This is only my opinion. It has nothing to do with any kind of a qualified point of view.
Well, of course your point of view is qualified.
Okay, great. That makes me feel liable in some way.
He has a wicked laugh, doesn't he?
So, no, but the truth of it is what I see is that we live in a day and age, not just with music, but in general, that people are going to get the products they want, how they want to get them. They're not going to be dictated to on how that's going to be delivered to them. I don't know that we can see all the delivery mechanisms and how distribution of that content may change or not. I think certainly there's a direct-to-consumer model that will grow and grow and grow, and that the walls will, this is my opinion, that the walls will continue to come down in and around some of the traditions of our business that has kept people out because you had to get through gatekeepers. I think a lot of those walls have been eliminated now, and I think there'll be more eliminated in the future where, you know, you'll be able to, I mean, you can do it now. You can go direct to consumer. If you can build enough demand, you don't have to do anything except deliver them digital content. You can ship CDs to their house if that's what you want to do. So, long story short, I think the other thing that's very, very interesting to me is, have you guys been involved and followed kind of the Bitcoin stuff and the blockchain technology?
Yeah, a little bit.
I think it's going to be interesting to see how that matures, and this is maybe a different meeting, but how that matures and how that starts to look for payments of royalties, and I think it'll be interesting also in the way that it starts to shape this business. There's lots of cool stuff online. You guys should go and study up on it a little bit and look in around at some of the three different areas that blockchain technology is looking to try and change, you know, the way that we're participating in the music business.
Those three areas being?
The main one that I was concerned about is the payment of royalties and streamlining that process. There's two other ones, and I don't know what they are, Tess, off the top of my head, but you have to go take a look.
All right.
But it's really cool stuff, and I think there's enough heat around it now, and there's enough people working on it that it might be interesting on how it changes the face of our business a little bit.
All right.
But in the meantime, guys, in closing, two things. Man, this is a cool business, and I'm glad that you guys are part of it. I think that you keep looking to make it great and make great music. And I think the rest of this stuff ends up kind of taking care of itself in a weird way. You got to manage your business, but it starts by making great music and great content. I think the last part of it is that I meant what I said earlier is we live in a world that everybody's kind of looking over their shoulder at what everybody else is doing, and I think there's lots of education, lots of learning to what other people are doing, and I think there's lots of mistakes that we've talked about a little bit in here that other people have made. That's a great education for people not to make the same ones. But there truly is no competition if you're the best in class. And if you get up every day and you work to be the best at what you do, and you're confident in being the best at what you do, it doesn't really matter what everybody else is doing because you'll be the gold standard for whatever it is that you're accomplishing. And I think if I could leave you with anything, that's the way I try to get up in the morning, is finding out how you'd be the best in class at the things that you're supposed to be doing and let the rest of the world take care of itself. You know, keep your focus on what it is you want to be and where you want to be and what that time frame you want to be in. If you read any of the traditional Think and Grow Rich or self-help books in and around that, it's about manifesting vision and absolutely making sure that you believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that you're going to get there. It starts there, and then you got to go and do some hard work.
Napoleon Hill, well done. Absolutely. Huge round of applause for Ron Spotted.
Thank you for listening. Join NARIP now and come to an event near you. NARIP. Get connected. Stay connected.